Hey, this is Megan Rapinoe.
And I'm Sue Bird.
We've decided to turn our crazy IG live show into a podcast for your listening pleasure. Enjoy the show.
A Touch More.
New episodes of A Touch More drop Tuesday only on the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores, the games every day. Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment. I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, Laker fans? Welcome to Laker Film Room Podcast, brought to you by BetOnline.ag. I'm Pete, joined as always by Darius. Today we're going to talk about what I believe to be the single most important change to basketball in terms of the rules in my lifetime. And that is, in prior to the 2001-2002 season, the league changed their illegal defense rule, eliminating it and replacing it with the defensive 3 seconds rule. And what that meant was, under the previous rules, off-ball defenders had to stay within arm's distance-ish of their player, or to go double team on the ball. They could not double team off of the ball. They could not play zone off of the ball. And that extended out to the three-point line. So, let's talk about how it used to be first, for those who either aren't old enough to know or remember, or it's been a while since they watched that kind of basketball. What was the impact? Like, what was basketball like back then before the illegal defense rule was eliminated?
I mean, so there was a lot of stuff with this too, right? So when you talk about what was basketball like back then before, with the old illegal defense rule, I think this sort of went hand in hand with the lack of emphasis on three-point shooting, right? And so, and I actually think that these two things sort of went hand in hand. And this is something we can get into the pod a little bit later in terms of the rule changes and the domino effect that happens. But with the old illegal defense rule, you could sort of artificially create spacing. You could send whoever you wanted sort of out beyond the three-point line, or hovering around the three-point line, and individual defenders who were guarding that player were sort of had to pay attention to him and sort of know where he was at any given time. Because let's say I'm guarding you, Pete, and you're sort of standing in the short corner area around the baseline, that area where Kobe hit many a game winner and many a fadeaway jumpers.
Right? Yeah, so if you don't know the short corner, that's about halfway between where the lane is and the three-point line.
Roughly. Exactly. So yeah. Let's say that you were standing right there and you're a power forward, and I'm AC Green and I'm defending you. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm AC Green. Maybe I have hey. Shiny hair today. So you decide, if I just start to pay attention way too much to the ball and I'm not looking at where you're at, you start to lurk away from me.
I start to back up to the three-point line, even
though
I can't shoot.
And back up to the three-point, even though you can't shoot. You are not a stretch power forward in 1983. I won't make you a Celtic or anything. Think of whatever you're Michael Cage.
Okay. And, I like that.
I am
AC
Green.
Nice Jerry curl going on.
Yeah. Both
speaking
of us,
good
right?
hair. Good hair. Yeah. We got good hair going on. Yeah.
It is a hair off. So if you lurk out behind the 3-point line and I'm watching the ball, then suddenly I'm in no man's land and I could easily get called for illegal defense. Mm-hmm. And what happened when I would get called for illegal defense, Pete?
It's a technical foul, one free throw, and we keep the ball, reset of the shot clock.
That's right. So that's a pretty damning defensive mistake to get called for illegal defense. And so the result of that was often a bunch of artificial spacing for the offensive team. And post play thrived.
Yeah, like to, if I could jump in, what teams would often do was they would cluster three guys on the on one side of the court, like your three worst offensive players, and it would be a lot of two-man game, right? So it would be like Magic and Kareem on one side, and say Worthy's not in the game or something, and then it's like, right, like Kurt Rambis and you know, Byron might come off a screen maybe, right? But and you know, pick your fifth guy, right? But somebody who's not a three-point threat, and they're all kind of clustered together while Magic and Kareem would be doing their thing. And this type of two-man game was very prominent around the league. We see two-man game now as being largely pick-and-roll based, but back then it was, we're just going to space the floor and make it kind of this two-on-two game and between our best players and creating all this space for them, and that was difficult to defend, so you start double teaming and then you can start getting benefits off of that. That happened in the 80s. Defenses started to kind of catch up to that and would send doubles, and then would that gives you more freedom on the weak side to, like, you didn't have to stay attached to the same guy, you just had to be within arm's distance of an offensive player, and you couldn't double team a guy, right? So when you doubled, when you did a hard double, it would be 3-on-2 on the weak side. And those two defenders, like, okay, you check Cutter, I'll check, you know, anybody right. trying to flash middle or, you know, or three-point shooter, however they wanted to defend it. And that's when we saw those scores start going down in the 90s, right? Is that defenses became more and more sophisticated on how they handled that.
And I would add, too, that the lack of emphasis of three-point shooting at that time often meant that even good perimeter shooters were not camping out behind the three-point arc when they were on the weak side, right? Mm-hmm. They might be spotting up at 20 feet or 18 mm-hmm. feet. And so the spacing often looked really shrunk on the weak side. And it made that zoning up of the weak side when you did send double teams almost easier to right. work with when you're on that backside, because you're not closing to 23 or 24 or 25 feet the way that mm-hmm. you are in today's NBA. You were closing out to 18 feet or 20 feet. And maybe if there was a Dale Ellis or a Chuck Person or a Hersey Hawkins or
Ricky Pierce, all them dudes were Sonics, man. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, right. If you were one of those guys, then maybe you were camped out behind the three-point line. And even back then, there were specialists, right? Like, Craig Hodges or all of those guys that were in
Trent
the three-point
Tucker,
contest.
Yeah.
Trent Tucker, another name, right? We are dating ourselves here, but this is great.
Yes.
So if you were one of those guys, you would camp out behind the three-point line, and it would make those rotations harder, and it was one of the reasons why those guys actually thrived in the league back then. It was because those rotations were hard, and guys were not used to closing out to that distance, and so a lot of shots that they got were open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely, and it's hard to pick apart what illegal defense was responsible for versus what, like a lack of understanding of analytics and good shots, right? Like even back when we were young, you know, coaches would always say and announcers would always say, like, that three pointer with your foot on the line is the worst shot in the game, right? Like that's been a trope as long as I've been alive. What wasn't understood, of course, was the notion that the really pretty much anywhere from like 3 or 4 feet away from the basket to the three-point line, the three was a better shot, right? We were a long way away from that, and I really don't think that started progressing until the late 2000s, or even earlier, maybe, you know, mid 2000s with D'Antoni and whatnot. So that made it all the easier. And again, we saw that reduction in points in the 90s. So what happened? We have the 80s. Scoring levels are at about the same level that they are now. Then we get to the 90s and we see, you know, like I just rewatched the 98 finals and like these games, bro, there was one finals game, Utah scored 54 points in that game. That
wasn't
normal.
College score. That's like a college score.
Yeah, man. And a lot of these games were in the 70s, in the 80s. And we saw that for quite a stretch in the NBA. It's really only been over the last 10 years with the analytics revolution, with the idea that shots at the rim, catch and shoot threes, and free throws are really the best way that you can get points. And offenses have really changed around that idea. Speak to that intermediate era before that the rule change in 2001 when the style of basketball started changing from the 80s.
Yeah, so the 90s were an interesting time for basketball because everyone sort of fashioned themselves as a bit of a physical team. Like the best teams in the league were defensive teams first and foremost. Even those Bulls teams with especially that second three-peat run, I mean, Jordan and Pippen and Rodman and Ron Harper, it was all of this like size and physical toughness that they were offering. Those Riley's Knicks teams, those Riley's then Heat teams, and then those Knicks teams continued under Jeff Van Gundy. A lot of the best teams in the league during that time were sort of grinded out defensive teams, or they played at a pace that was very much slowed down and played into the hands of that physical style. Like those, I wouldn't say that those Jazz teams were necessarily great defensive teams, but they were physical teams, and they would foul you and they would maul you on both sides of the ball, right? Like they'd set a bunch of hard, sometimes illegal screens. They would clutch and hold defensively. I remember one of the reasons why, as a Lakers fan, I strongly disliked those Jazz teams was because they played under the premise that, almost like in football, how you can't call holding on every play. You couldn't. The Jazz played a style where Jerry Sloan clearly thought you can't call a foul on every single play. Like, you just can't. And so a lot of those freedom of movement fouls that we see now.
Bro, the screens that John Stockton used to set, man. Like, Stockton used to set the dirtiest freaking screens, man.
Do you remember the screen that Julius Randle set on Gordon Hayward to
in Kobe's last
Kobe
game?
Right for that last game-winning shot? That was basically... Yeah. All screens.
That was John Stockton's career. No, that was especially Stockton, and he was small enough to where it was like, oh, what, me? Like, what? Anyway, yeah, I could go on. But
the point I was making, too, about those freedom of movement fouls that we see now where you can't really bump cutters, you can't impede movement when guys are moving through the lane. All that stuff is born out of the fact that those rules were different back in the 90s, or at least they were called differently, right? And so you would be able to bump a cutter off of a spot. If there was a cross screen that was set from lane line to lane line, which was a common action back in the 90s in order to free post players, and it often was a guard who would go and set that screen on that big man, it would be the defensive guard who was guarding the player or who was defending the player who went to go set that screen. He would often just stand right in the way of that big man. And if that big man trucked him, the big man might be called for a foul.
Sure.
Whereas in today's NBA, if you impede that big man coming across the lane, that's a foul on you.
Yeah, that was, like, as a coach, you always teach that to, like, check cutters, right? Like, if you're in a zone or even if you're in man-to-man, right? Like, if you can drop down and put a little forearm in his ribs, like, that's what you're supposed to do. That was taught for years and years.
No, it's how I grew up playing the game.
Sure.
And I mean, people probably still look at me now. If I were to go out there and play pickup now, I would probably still be playing that because it was just ingrained in my head that this is how you play, right? Like there is a certain amount of physicality you play with defensively in order to muck up the game a little bit. And that was the essence of 90s basketball. And it came off of this wonderful era, I feel like, of 80s basketball, where the pace was so much faster, and while there was a lot of physicality in that game as well, the top teams, the Lakers, the Celtics, even the 76ers, some of those Rockets teams, they would, even though they played post-oriented basketball offensively, mostly through their big men like Moses Malone and Kareem and then Ralph Sampson and Hakeem, those teams could still get out and run. They would play in the fast break. They would play some open court basketball. And it was a good brand of basketball to watch overall, especially when the best team in the league for that decade was basically our team, the Lakers.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah, I think we might remember it less fondly if we were not Laker fans. But thank God we are.
Yes.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk about the 2001 rule change and kind of what happened afterward. With currently no NBA, NHL, or MLB, you might think there's nothing to bet on, but you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline, still has hundreds of events, games, and props to wager on. From their online casino to poker and blackjack, they're bringing Vegas to you. If you're missing the NFL, no problem. BetOnline has live, daily Madden NFL 20 simulations you can bet on. You can still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. All open 24 hours a day and all online. Go to betonline.ag and use promo code BLUEWIRE to join today and receive your welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online wagering solution. All right, so again, in 2001, this is right before the Lakers' last championship of their three-peat. The league eliminates the illegal defense rule. But I've always thought, like the three-point line is an example of this, is when a major rule change happens in the NBA, that doesn't always mean that teams adapt to it right mm-hmm. away, right? Like they understand how to use it. The three-point line was kind of this novelty for several years of its existence. And then you'd have a couple guys popping up here and there. And now, you know, I think it's been like 20 straight years or you know, even more where three-point attempts have increased from the year before. But for the first bit of it, it wasn't really that. I would argue that something similar happened with the elimination of the illegal defense rule, is that even though it was gone, I believe that the first team to really use it well was the 2008 Boston Celtics with Tom Thibodeau and Kevin Garnett, the amoeba defense, the Lakers' strong side zone. Kurt Rambis led that in 2009. That was, first off, do you agree with that? And what did those, like the Thibodeau defense, the Lakers' strong side zone, how did that change? How did that affect how basketball was played?
No, and so I agree. I couldn't agree more. Like, I was just nodding my head because I could already tell where you were going with that. Those early Celtics teams with Tom Thibodeau as the defensive coordinator under Doc Rivers, they were the first team to sort of really start to shrink the floor on the strong side, the ball side, that made it so that the best course of action was to either swing the ball quickly or effectively skip the ball across the court with sort of cross-court passes, right? Mm-hmm. And that defense gave those Lakers fits in 2008 during the finals, and it was such a good defensive tactic that the Lakers and Kurt Rambis almost essentially started to copy it, right?
Sure,
They used very similar principles, but leveraged a little bit more of the quickness and length that the Lakers had at their disposal versus some of the physicality that those Celtics teams had. Right?
The Lakers also had, like, they had more shot blocking than, like, those Celtics teams were physical, but we had, like, Twin Towers with Powell and Bynum, and then we could go to this totally different look with Lamar and Powell, right? And, like, their coverages could be different than if Bynum was on the floor. So, yeah, it's also, like, very big-centric, like, what your bigs are capable of doing.
No, exactly right. So, one of the things that, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but the Celtics love to, those Celtics teams love to ice ball screens.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So they love to force the ball baseline, and they love to have weak side defenders lurking, right? And so one of the classic examples of how most offenses worked, and this was the triangle offense worked like this as well, is you might have a post entry and then a speed cut or a split cut, depending on who, on how many players were on the strong side. They would cut off of the post and they would clear a side, and it would essentially create a mid post or a post isolation, right? Whenever that, one thing that the Celtics did effectively is when you would make a post entry and then cut off of the post, the guard would follow, but then he would linger, and he would linger in the paint and then sort of show strong side zone action that if you're going to drive the ball, then you're going to see you're going to see a defender early, right? And a lot of it was to discourage a drive at all, to make a to make the offensive player want to shoot that mid-range jump shot, or for that player to pass, right? Because you're running a mid-post isolation typically for your best offensive player. You're not throwing the ball to Kendrick Perkins and saying, go get me a bucket,
big. Go clear out a side.
They're throwing the ball to Kobe Bryant, or if you're even Boston, you're throwing that ball to Paul Pierce.
Carmelo Anthony got those touches.
Tracy McGrady, right?
A lot of mid-post wings. That style of play is really not around as much anymore.
No, it's not. Well, I mean, the power wing is...
It's not gone, but it's not...
It's not gone, but the best... The thing is that there are fewer of those players who are effective scoring from that spot on the floor in general, and I think part of that is because that part of the game is being de-emphasized, right?
Right.
But if you were to talk about the three or four best power wings in the league, they all still thrive in that area.
LeBron James, Kawhi,
Kevin Durant, even Giannis can thrive from that position, mostly as a turn and face and driving option, not necessarily as a like jab.
No,
jumper
guy. He's not a triple threat guy. Yeah.
Yes, he's not. But I mean, he will get you in triple threat. It's just that he'll then just body you and then explode, and then he's at the rim,
right?
With like a half a step, he's at the rim. But getting back to some of those strong side zone principles, a lot of it was just crowding the strong side with bodies and arms, and making sure that if anyone was going, if the man with the ball was going to penetrate there, he was going to run into extra defenders, oftentimes size, right?
Right. If I can jump in real quick, just if people aren't aware, like strong side means the side of the court that the ball is on, right? So teams were putting one more guy on the side of the court. Like, so you remember Kobe on the wing, which is like the free throw line extended, right? Kind of where the 3-point line turns and goes toward the corner and goes into a straight line, kind of in that area, but like, you know, 18, 20 feet away, right? So anyway, but the strong side, if you're not aware of the term, is just the side of the court that the ball's on. So if that's confusing, hopefully that clears that up. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, and so to sort of contrast that versus the defenses that we were talking about from the 90s, in the 90s, you would have to come and double-team the ball hard, right? Mm-hmm. Like you would need to actually have two defenders on the basketball, and that made your passing reads easier, right? With the implementation of zone defenses and a defense of 3 seconds, that player did not have to come and commit a full-on double team. He could linger around, and as long as he was not in the painted area for 3 seconds or longer consecutively, then he was okay to just continue to linger in in that space, and it created these zone looks on the weak side of the floor that were very hard to dissect back in 2007, 2008, and even up until 2010, 2011, it really did take a few years for offenses to start to catch up and figure out the best way to attack these, well, these types of schemes.
Yeah, and I would argue that even into today's game, we see a lot of that. Now, what those schemes, it makes intuitive sense, right? You move one more body over to the side of the court that the ball's on. If you can get the ball from one that side of the court to the other side of the court, you've got an advantage, right? So those types of zones are really vulnerable to skip passes and the things that help facilitate skip passes, right? So pin screens, meaning that like, oh, you're gonna shift a little bit over to the side of the court where the ball is. Well, we're going to set screens on you to pin you there. Like, good, stay there. And then we're going to throw the ball over the top with a guy like LeBron, ideally, right? And now we've got a shooter that's wide open as a result of that, right? So it was part and parcel to the growth of the importance of the three-point line, not just further understanding that, like, yeah, actually it being 3 points versus 2 points is like 50% more, and that's a lot. It beyond that, it also went to the to adjusting to how do we still get the impact, the offensive impact of our dominant wings, right? While but doing it in a different way. Like, these guys are drawing extra attention. How do we maximize that to take advantage of that? Like, you know, I was watching the series in 2010. I did that whole series for The Athletic. And we didn't really know how to do that yet, and part of it was personnel, right? Like, the Celtics just didn't guard Ron Artest for pretty much the whole series behind the three-point line and sent a lot of extra help that way, right? Like, part of that is you can't have, really, in today's game, Ron Artest and Powell and Bynum in the front court in terms of three-point shooting, right? Like, it's just, you got to have you pretty much at least four guys who are credible three-point threats. And with Powell and Bynum at the time, neither of them were, and Artest was below average at that point of his career. So that became a huge liability for the Lakers offensively. But so that started to shift the, like, what do I need from my small forward? It became like, oh, like a small forward who couldn't shoot, like, you can't really play him that much. And then it became a power forward that can't shoot. You can't really play him that much. And now a lot of times, traditional fives are having a hard time staying on the floor in crunch time and in bigger moments. So, yeah, I think that, like, that's kind of the progression, is the elimination of the illegal defense rule led to zone, strong side zone type action and the amoeba defense that were geared toward, like, the other team's got this one dude that's really incredible. We've got to limit him. But if we double team him, that's easy, like, wide open jumpers for other guys. How do we get the best of both worlds, right? So that's the next step. And then scoring drops, and you get those 83 to 79 games again, like we did in the 90s. Then personnel starts changing to, both in terms of understanding analytics, but also in response to this, like, oh, well, if we've got somebody on the weak side who can catch and let it fly, yeah, we're going to take advantage of that.
No, so I want to jump in on that point there specifically with the determination that teams need more shooting that's on the floor. We talked about this earlier in the pod, but with the old illegal defense rule, you could manufacture spacing simply by player positioning, right? Mm-hmm. And in today's NBA, you can only manufacture spacing by actually having credible threats behind the mm-hmm. floor. And it's a bit of a chicken and the egg thing, right? Like, the way that you're explaining it, I'm nodding my head and agreeing with that. And I do think that finding more shooting to put on the floor very much is a response to the fact that teams were shrinking the floor defensive teams were shrinking the floor against an offensive team's best players all of the time, and it was limiting the amount of quality shots that a team was going to get from its best players, because it was effectively neutering them and limiting their ability to get to spots on the floor where those players could get the highest percentage shots, right? Like, usually at, like, right at the basket, because that's what the best players in the world do. They score at the rim, which is one of the reasons why centers were always so prized, right? Mm-hmm. Dating back in throughout the history of the league, because guess what? When you're tall, it helps you put the ball in the basket very close to the basket, and that's the point of the damn game. Fast forward, though, and teams were no longer able to manufacture that spacing simply by placing players in these designated spots on the floor. They actually needed a credible threat there, and it's sort of a chicken and the egg, right? Like, we're going to hurt you by making more three-pointers if you don't respect those shooters. But if you respect those shooters, guess what? I've now created the same spacing that we were talking about teams had in the 1980s, right? Because you are now no longer able to crowd the best wing players by showing strong side zone action as often, right? Because if you're defending LeBron James, and we saw this as Lakers fans, especially this year in comparison to last year, right? Like, really, that's the only comparison that you need to make in terms of understanding this concept effectively, is when last year's Lakers were trying to put LeBron in the mid post and space the floor with Lance Stephenson and Lonzo Ball and Rajon Rondo and Brandon Ingram, right? Guys who were not taking and making three-pointers at a high rate. Guess what? That strong side zone look stayed forever, and sometimes full-on double teams were coming just because opposing coaches were not fearful of the shooters that the Lakers had on the floor. Fast forward to this year, and it's you know lineups with Danny Green and KCP, and those guys are effectively spacing the floor for LeBron James, and that meant more often coaches were in this do I or don't I position of doubling or even showing the types of strong side looks that a passer of the caliber that LeBron is would just defeat with skip passes right over the top with any sort of effective weak side screen action. And and that is the essence of today's game, right? And that's how you beat those actions today. But it's interesting because without the shooting, none of it works, right?
Right.
And that's the point that you were making that I feel like is it that it's so important that you need the shooters? This is what I wanted to ask you. Are there ways to scheme this without the shooters that you could imagine? Or is it really just a zero-sum game? You need the shooters now, and that's the only way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you need the shooters, and that's the only way to do it. You can hide one guy by having him as the screen setter, especially. I think of guys like Draymond and Ben Simmons, especially Ben Simmons, right, where having Simmons either in the corner and diving from there or setting screens from there, or having him as the ball screener or setting screens off the ball. Like, if guys play way off of them and you have Ben Simmons screening for a quality shooter, then if he makes contact on that screen, the guy who's playing off of him is not going to be able to help on that shooter, right? So that's a way to pull a guy out of the paint when he's defending Ben Simmons, even though Ben Simmons himself is not much of a shooter. But it's almost one of those, like, if you can't get it from one guy, you need to have another guy who's not just like he's a good shooter, like, he'll catch and shoot 39%, but like, holy crap, that's Klay Thompson coming off the screen, like, red alert, we have to defend this, right? So if you're going to have guys like that can't shoot, you need to make up for that even more so in someone else. So I think, you know, Pat Riley said in the late 80s that we were going, in 25 years, I think he said, everyone was going to be 6'9 and able to dribble, pass, and shoot. And that was we're not all the way there. We may not be for a long time, but it's fairly prophetic. And so that leads me to that kind of prediction of the future, leads me to kind of where we're going next. For me, this season was the most interesting defensive season that I can remember. There was way more zone, more 2-3, 1-2-2, the stuff that teams were doing to Harden, right, where they were doubling him in half court. I think Nick Nurse does really, really cool stuff on the defensive end. They were doing some diamond press. Like, this gets me, like, one thing I love about the high school game is that, like, pressing and half court traps and stuff that you can get it to work, right? So it's, from a coaching perspective, it's a lot more, there's just a lot more on the menu that you can choose from. And I've always wondered, like, it's been the thought that in the NBA for years and years, they're too good of shooters, you can't play zone. And I was like, I'd love to see them try. Like, maybe it's not something you could do 90% of the time in the way that you do with a man-to-man defense, but I thought, you know, and the numbers back this up, you know, a lot of teams were executing their zones really well. And I'm just curious to see, kind of, where do you think the application of this rule and what the latest, the next kind of evolution of it will be?
No, I definitely think we're going to see more zone. I also think that it's interesting as the analytics get better and as teams get smarter in terms of targeting and targeting specific players and figuring out where their weaknesses are as shooters, right? Because a 40% three-point shooter often does not mean he shoots 40% from everywhere. Right?
Right.
Like, right. He might shoot 42 or 43% from the corners, and he's a high-volume corner three-point shooter, and he shoots 36% on lower volume from above the break, right? And so as you were talking about more zone defense and the idea that teams that NBA players are too good a shooter to play zone against, right? Well, what flies in the face of some of that is what, like, Milwaukee did this year as a defensive team. Now, they didn't play a lot of zone. In fact, they barely played any zone at all. They basically played a traditional man-to-man scheme with drop coverage and sort of soft coverage at the point of attack with their big men while their guard tried to fight over the top of screens. And Milwaukee surrendered a ton of three-pointers, man. Like, I don't know if it was the most in the league, but they were up there in terms of most surrendered threes. Mm-hmm. And they were the best defensive team in the league in terms of defensive efficiency by a mile, right? Mm-hmm. Like, by 2 or 3 points per 100 possessions, which is a lot in terms of defensive efficiency. And so I'll be very interested in seeing how defenses evolve to surrender even more above the break threes to the types of shooters who are not necessarily effective at shooting from that spot. You know, one of the questions I was going to ask you, though, is do you envision these rule changes or any other additional rule changes like in the next 10 to 15 years? Like, it seems like every 20 or 25 years we start to see like tweaks within how the game is called or full-on rule changes, right? Like the elimination of the hand check, the implementation of zone defense, the introduction of the three-point line. There's always something. And after a while, even this style of basketball that a lot of people love will start to get stale.
I would argue it already is, honestly.
Yeah, and we're already starting to see, like, stylistic pushback, right? Like, all teams, they just play the same, which isn't necessarily true. They play, a lot of teams play differently, but the end result in terms of shot quality and the types of shots that they're taking are the same. So do you envision any rule changes coming? And if not, what would you, like, recommend?
So I don't envision major rule changes anytime soon, but I would like them. And I really enjoyed this conversation, and I would like to do this as our next podcast.
Ah, yeah.
Tease
it up.
The NBA needs to make the mid-range a viable option again. We have lost some of the beauty of the sport in the technical proficiency that's required for triple threat skills, which is a triple threat is when you catch the ball and you still have your dribble alive, right? You haven't started to dribble yet. And, you know, you put the ball down right around your hip. And from there, you can raise up for your jumper, you can attack off of the drive, or you're in good position to pass. That's why they call it triple threat. There are three different things you can do from that position. And, you know, rewatching a lot of Michael Jordan's games for, you know, a couple pieces I've worked on for The Athletic, and watching Kobe over seven games in 2010, guys like Melo, like, the mid-range shot is not an efficient shot because going from 2 points to 3 points on a shot is really severe, right? Like, it's 50% more, and you have to shoot, you know, like, what, they shoot league shoots 36-ish%, 35.5% mm-hmm. from three. So in order for that to make sense from two, you got to make it 54% of the time.
Yeah.
Well, there are like three guys in the NBA that shoot 54% from mid-range, right? So it's always going to be a better shot almost every time, unless it depends on play by play. But in terms of the desired shots that an offense is going for, the league needs to get to a place where a team can win with a dominant mid-range player, and that be like the staple of their offense. Now, the ways to do that, do you extend the three-point line out a lot farther than it is now? Do you make it worth 2.5 points to score from a certain, like, you can get crazy, right? But in terms of they need to find ways to bring that back into the game. Do you have an idea of something you'd like to see?
Do you want to get into it now, or do you want to save it for the next pod?
Let's do it on the next one.
All right, sounds good.
You've been listening to Laker Film Room Podcast. We will catch you guys next time.